0670. Appearing for the appellants, Brian Lawler will be arguing this morning. Ronald Parsons Jr. is present, appearing. Appearing and arguing on behalf of the appellee is Robert Anderson, and also appearing is Lieutenant Colonel Jason Campbell from the Staff Judge Advocate Office. Each side will have 15 minutes for your initial argument, and then Mr. Lawler, you'll have a 5-minute rebuttal. You can proceed at this time.
Mr. Chief Justice, my friends at council table, and may it please the court. This is a case of first impression, and a rather unique one at that. We are here to ask a state court, this court specifically, to interpret federal statutes for the benefit of 7 employees, some of whom are present today, who work for both the state of South Dakota and the federal government. And the benefits at issue are unquestionably federal benefits. This is a novel case, but this is a very important case. This case arises under the Uniformed Services Employment and Reemployment Rights Act, or USERRA, as I will refer to it. The main purpose of that statute is to protect the rights of service members when they leave their civilian employment and perform military service obligations. USERRA was enacted in 1994. It is the latest in a series of veteran or service member protection statutes dating back to 1940 and the Selective Training and Service Act. That was enacted because the vast majority of the service members who fought in World War II were civilians. And when they left to fight World War II, Congress thought it important to make sure that their civilian jobs were protected upon their return. The 7 plaintiff appellants in this case are indisputably federal civilian employees. Under Title 32 of the United States Code, Section 709, that's the National Guard Technician Act. But they're called dual status technicians. For although they are federal employees for almost every purpose under the sun, under USERRA, they are state employees. That is evident in that their employer is the South Dakota Air National Guard. The named defendant is properly the Adjutant General of the South Dakota Air National Guard. Jurisdiction for a technician's USERRA case rests exclusively in state courts, but they are paid with federal dollars and they are subject to all the employment laws and protections of Title V. Under Title V, the U.S. Code 6323A, federal civilian employees who perform military service obligations are entitled to accrue and use 15 days of paid military leave per fiscal year.
Although 6323A1 doesn't say use, it just says accrue.
That's correct, Your Honor. What says use?
But you've got to be able to accrue it before you can use it.
That's correct.
That distinction may come in. I've got some thoughts on that. I'm going to let you press on, but there may be a distinction there, but 6323A1 talks about accrual. And if I might, actually, now that I've stopped you and disrupted you, forgive me for that. But there was some testimony from General Bartenik, and I was trying to kind of put this into perspective, and I don't know if I got it quite right, but there was a question along the lines of, hey, what brings us here? What's this dispute about? And the testimony was along the lines of, or the answer was along the lines of, well, you know, we have these dual status technicians who are on AGR orders and they wanted to use military leave. Do you recall that testimony?
I do.
Is that right? I mean, isn't it more about accrual? I mean, there's no prohibition in 709G2 from, it just says A1 doesn't apply. There's nothing in 709G2 that says you can't use military leave.
That's correct, Your Honor. So, and I appreciate the correction, or the steer, perhaps. The Code of Federal Regulations, it's 5 CFR 353.208, and it's a really short passage, and it is what provides that military leave accrued under 6323A must be allowed to be used. So that's, we take a step over. And sometimes the question arises, well, that's a code of federal regulations. Why does that, that's not a statute. Let me make sure we're very clear on this. When Congress enacted USERRA in 1994, it charged the Department of Labor with promulgating regulations to explain in lay terms what USERRA means. Now, 5 CFR 353-208, as we're discussing, is not that. But that's codified in 20 CFR section 1002, and those are the plain language explanations of what USERRA means. So I just want to make sure the distinction. I was asked once by an appellate panel, you're not suggesting the CFRs are statutes. I'm not, but they are important. They're federal regulations. And as Your Honor pointed out, there's a carve-out. Right? So 32 U.S.C. 709G holds that persons performing active guard and reserve duty, as that is defined in Title 10, U.S. Code 101D10.
D6.
Thank you. That's what I have written. For a period of 180 days or more for the purpose of organizing, administering, recruiting, instructing, or training the reserve components. So there are two things I just said that are dispositive here, which is what makes the conversion to Title 10 important. First of all, AGR has to be for 180 days or more, and it has to be in support of the reserve component, organizing, administering, basically those sorts of tasks.
So do you agree, though, that if a dual status technician serves an active guard and reserve duty, satisfies that definition, and it's one of those definitions, it's an exception, so if you want the military leave, you don't want to satisfy the criteria, but if they do, they do. And so that would take them out of the eligibility to have that benefit in 6323A1.
Correct.
But you have a temporal requirement, right? You have that 180 days.
Right.
In addition to the purpose, which is the training, administration, organization, recruiting with guard and reserve components. So as I understand your argument, you are arguing that Title 10 orders are significant to accrual. And in your brief, forgive me, I don't have the page right in front of me right now, I just have notes on it. But in your brief, it seems as though at one point you're counting days on Title 10 orders. But the D6, the 101 D6 definition seems to be all about active guard and reserve duty, and the temporal requirement would seem to apply to the Article 32 orders, not the Title 10 orders.
That's correct, Your Honor. And the reason we pointed out the accrual of the Title 10 time is to show that except one, Ms. Lambert, who went over 180 days on her Title 10 time, everyone else's Title 10 orders were for less than 180 days.
But what difference does that make?
It takes us out of any possible definition of AGR time, because AGR has to be in excess of 180 days.
AGR, though, would be the Article 32
Correct.
Orders, not the Article 10
right.
orders.
Well, but my friend's contention is that, well, it's all AGR time. Whether it converted or didn't convert, it's all AGR time. They started as AGR orders, and they ended as AGR orders, and therefore the conversion to Title 10 is immaterial for
right.
this analysis. That's incorrect. But while we're on the topic, and I think this is probably the most important point to distinguish between Title 10 time and AGR duties, the duties that they performed, every one of them under Title 10 time were supporting the active duty component. So again, AGR support the reserve component. They're supporting the active component. Most of them were deployed to Bagram Air Base under the Presidential Emergency Declaration 13-223 in 2001.
But if we're trying to isolate on so the general rule is dual status technicians, like everybody else, when they're in a civilian capacity, would qualify for 15 days of military leave under 6323A1. They don't, though, under 32 U.S.C. 709G2, if they're performing active guard and reserve duty as defined in 10 U.S.C. 101D6, that definition isolates the active guard and reserve duty, not the Title 10 active duty supportive mission duty.
That's right, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's our contention, is that the conversion, although my friends dispute that, the conversion is relevant. And, in fact, it's the only relevant analysis in our opinion and factually, that once the conversion occurs, the state, the Air National Guard, South Dakota Air National Guard, no longer has any control over the plaintiffs and appellants. They are now exclusively under federal control. They are now Title 10 service members. They are, in some cases, deployed. Operation Freedom Sentinel is a Department of Defense named contingency operation. It continues with the global war on terror, and the state of South Dakota has absolutely no control over what they do.
So if someone serves, so as is the case here, some of these plaintiffs serve for a length of time under the AGR, they serve AGR duty for 180 days plus, and really it's not in the orders, but the orders say, as you know, 32 U.S.C. 328, which is kind of the AGR section. So maybe we can glean from that that that's the purpose of the orders. It doesn't seem to be an issue. Mr. Vorhoff seemed to acknowledge that in front of the trial court. So this appears to be, let's say it goes on for 185 days, and it's AGR duty. And then there's Title 10 orders. And leaving the argument of the Adjutant General off to the side for a minute, so the Title 10 orders would affect a change in legal authority and status, right? You're no longer serving as a member of a state militia. You're now part of a federal component of the armed forces.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So isn't it significant, though, that before they went on those Title 10 orders, they were ineligible under 709G2? That wouldn't be true if they served less than 180 days, but it would be true if they served more than 180 days.
It's worth noting, but I don't know that it's significant, nor does it change the analysis. If they were on AGR, performing AGR duty, and I think, by the way, I keep saying the word duty, the briefs reference, and certainly my friend's briefs reference, orders, and the general's testimony at trial was orders. They say AGR, they start as AGR, they finish as AGR, therefore they're AGR. That's not true, and I think it's a very important distinction to make sure this court understands that the trial court didn't, is we're talking about the nature of the duty. One piece of paper that reads starts AGR, finishes AGR.
So my question was, thank you, comments. And I'm interrupting you, and I'm sorry about that, but we're working away.
I'll call your question.
So in those instances where one service member, one guard member is below the temporal threshold of 180 days, consecutive days or more, one's above, they both are issued Title 10 orders. Do we have to account for the Title 32 duty differently?
No, we don't have to account for it at all.
Okay.
Because
why
it's
not?
It's not dispositive to the analysis. We understand, acknowledge that law is clear that while performing AGR duty, one does not qualify for 6323A accrual of 15 days of military leave. We acknowledge that. That's not at issue here. Once the conversion to Title 10 occurs, I think it's also equally indisputable that the eligibility for leave under 6323A does start.
Okay. I have one more argument. I'm sorry to keep doing this.
Please.
So let's say, though, in this case is about Title 10 accrual, right? So a service member before or after the 180 days is eclipsed, goes, accepts Title 10 orders, their status changes, and your argument is that at that point they're indistinguishable from their non-AGR contemporaries. They're entitled to accrue the 15 days. Did they get it, by the way, right there on the spot? I mean, because, you know, accrual is, you know, 15 days, you don't get it per pay period. You just get the 15 days per fiscal year.
I think I understand what Your Honor is asking. I apologize for interrupting.
No, please.
I understand what Your Honor is asking. Let's use some dates. So on June 1st, one of the plaintiff's appellants would have begun his or her AGR time. And on September 1st, they would have started their Title 10 time.
Yeah.
If on September 1st, they said, I want to take 15 days of my next 15 days, I want it to be paid annual leave, they could take it that day. So September 1st to 15th would be paid military leave.
So the restriction would be that second paragraph of 6323A1 where it talks about accrual. You can't carry more than 15
right.
over. That's
right.
The accrual.
Okay. Maybe using September was a bad example because it gets
no, but I got you.
Year thing. But,
so
right.
Last question. So what if a member goes and falls below the 180 mark? They do not satisfy the 101D6 definition. So wouldn't 6323A1 apply?
I don't know that that issue is before us today because we're not making that argument.
Okay,
we're not making that argument. We're making the argument that how much time is spent performing AGR duties is completely irrelevant to the analysis of whether once they go on start performing Title 10 duty, are they entitled to the accrual? And the answer is clearly yes, they are.
So, counsel, anti-military animus is now part of this case.
It shouldn't be.
Do you agree with opposing counsel that it's a legal issue, or do you believe it is a fact-based issue like intent?
Well, no, it's a legal issue, Your Honor. I mean, the Federal Circuit has made it clear, most recently 3 years ago, that when a benefit at issue is a military benefit solely available to members of the...
Let me just interrupt you, and we're at 15 minutes. Well, I'm just going to add 5 minutes to both sides' time for your initial arguments, because I think you're...
Thank you, Your Honor.
They'll give both sides a little bit more time to get through some of these issues and the anti-military animus.
Thank you, Your Honor. So the Federal Circuit's clear about that, and it's a matter of law. And I think the trial court committed an error of law in... We don't question the sua sponte thing. Our friends make some points in their brief about courts can do things sua sponte. We don't disagree with that. That's fine. But it was an error of law to make the contention that the trial court did that there needed to be a showing of anti-military animus. The Federal Circuit's clear about this, and although that is not binding on this court, and we're well aware that that's not binding on this court, first of all, it's a circuit court of appeals. It's the only circuit court of appeals to which appeals from the Merit Systems Protection Board can be taken, and that's where most federal employees USERRA cases go. Our plaintiffs and appellants are different because, as we mentioned earlier, they're state employees for USERRA. And I think most important, though, to Your Honor's question, there is no law to the contrary. None. There's not a single case to the contrary that suggests that when the benefit at issue is solely available to members of the military, there needs to be showing of anti-military animus. There just doesn't. I know our friends point out in their brief other cases that have found you need to have that, but the benefits at issue are not solely military benefits. And we don't question a wrongful termination case. You would have to show an anti-military animus to have any kind of standing to bring that case. That's not the issue here. Did I answer your question?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice.
Mr. Anderson, you can proceed.
Mr. Chief Justice, if it pleases the court and counsel, my name is Rob Anderson. I'm here representing Major General Mark Morrell, who is the head of the South Dakota National Guard, the Adjutant General. And with me as co-counsel is Lieutenant Colonel Jason Campbell, who is the Staff Judge Advocate. As Mr. Lawler accurately stated, this is a dispute about the right to military leave, whether it's accrual or utilization. And there's no question that the plaintiffs were entitled to that military leave when they served as civilian employees as dual status technicians. But when they received AGR, Active Guard Reserve orders, and accepted those orders, they became full-time active duty soldiers and were no longer entitled to those benefits. And we,
Mr. Anderson, that's not exactly true. If they serve for less than 180 days, they have to satisfy the definition under 10 U.S.C. 101D6.
That's the plaintiff's argument. We don't concede that applies here because our position is that the AGR orders were overarching and were always in effect. Something had to be in effect, and that prohibition always applied.
So Mr. Alder points out, and the text bears this out, the prohibition of 32 U.S.C. 709G2 talks about active guard and reserve duty. The definition which incorporates at 10 U.S.C. 101D6 talks about performing duty.
Yep.
How is it that, in what authority do you rely upon for your legal position that the Adjutant General or whoever, whatever, National Guard Authority issued these Article 32 orders. How can that preempt really the textual component that says this is about duty? In other words, the orders themselves let you answer. I'm sorry.
No.
The orders themselves aren't, I mean, we have statutes. That's authority. We might even have CFR regulations. That can be authoritative. The orders themselves animate the authority. They are not themselves the authority. Do you agree?
Well, what else but the orders changed the plaintiff's status from civilian employees to AGR active duty soldiers?
That changed it once. Of course, as we know, it got changed a couple times along the way because that they didn't remain indefinitely on that.
The AGR orders were never rescinded, never disappeared, were always there. They're there today.
So is it your view then that a member of the National Guard can serve simultaneously in an Article 32 status and under Article 2, I keep saying Article 32, which is UCMG article, Title 32 status and a Title 10 status simultaneously as a member of a state militia and the federalized component of the armed forces at the same time?
For the reason that there's so many moving parts here, that's the position that the National Guard takes and took in this
What authority case. Supports that?
They look first at the chain of status. First, civilian dual status technician employee. Second, AGR soldier, clearly prohibited initially from accruing or utilizing military leave. I don't think anybody disputes that.
Well, I think I do, because that prohibition's not categorical. It's subject to the definition that is listed in D6. Now, if you want to say, well, these Article 32 orders continue indefinitely in way more than 180 days, then I get your argument on that. But then you're going to have to, it seems to me, you're going to have to justify how a member of the Guard can serve simultaneously under the authority of Title 32 and the authority of Title 10.
Well, as I understand your question, you're doing the reverse that the National Guard took when the plaintiffs made this application. That is, you're saying because there's reference in the order, they weren't serving as under Title 10 initially when they got these orders.
No, I understand that.
Right. So don't you agree that they were precluded from accruing and utilizing military leave at that time?
Well, they would have to satisfy that. So it's the duty. It's not the orders.
Yeah, I think
it's active at standby. So it's active Guard and Reserve duty. It's not active Guard and Reserve orders.
Right. Duty and order is different.
Yeah. So the duty is defined in 10 U.S.C. 101 D6. That doesn't just say you get the orders, you're categorically barred forever. It says, among other things, it has to be for 180 consecutive days or more.
There are a number of things that have to be satisfied. I understand that. But the National Guard's position was initially, once they got and accepted those orders, they were precluded. And that preclusion continued.
That may be their position. My question, though, a little bit earlier was, what is that based on in terms of legal authority?
Their continuing AGR status.
That's not authority. That's not a statute. That's not a case. What is the authority for your position?
Well, do you know they weren't? Do we know? I'm not asking you.
It's all right. We're having a good visit.
Do we know that they weren't performing AGR duties initially?
I suspect they were.
I suspect they were, too.
But what is your authority for saying, I mean, you have to, your brief doesn't cite 101 D6. That's incorporated under 709 G2. I don't know how you can reach that issue and resolve that issue without looking at 101 D6.
I understand that what appellants refer to as the textual interpretation, it's complex. You brought up one thing in your earlier questions of appellant's counsel, that is, how do they determine in a bookkeeping exercise when you're on AGR, when you're on Title 10, when you can accrue leave, when you can't? This leave is supposed to be granted at the beginning of every fiscal year, 15 days, for training purposes, basically. So do you do that not knowing what their status is going to be?
Well, I think
It's not my turn to ask you questions. You're here to ask me questions.
That's so. Okay. I think you just apply the rules. Cool. I mean, they get it under 5 U.S.C. 6323A1 if they're an employee. They are. Mm-hmm. They don't get it if they are performing AGR duty under 709 G2 as defined in 101 D6. let's just apply those rules.
As I said, there's a lot of moving parts here, and you have to consider all of them. I'll certainly agree with that.
Well, those moving parts seem to be the controlling rules.
The definition, we do not agree that the application of the definition in 110 takes them out of AGR service.
Okay.
I just have another, like, a what-if sort of question, because as I understand opposing counsel's argument seems to be, and this obviously isn't the position you're advocating for, but if we were to agree that because of the language in those orders refer to converting to Title 10 and reverting back, and so if we were to determine there is this carve-out period in there where they are serving under Title 10 order and not an AGR order, how would, in trying to interpret this together, is there a way then that the military leave could accrue for this shorter period while they are on that Title 10, if that were to be what we would determine?
There's a little bit of everything in the orders for both sides here. And they like the word convert, and we like the word include. And that's one of the reasons I had the prior discussion with Justice Salter. That's a good question.
So
can I do one follow-up? Was there a practical way, then, that you could apply the military leave or afford it during a carve-out?
I don't know how. And I've been trying to figure that out myself. Now, I'm not as experienced as Mr. Waller obviously is with all the regulations, but I can tell you I'm not aware of any solution to that question. Okay. We got into this, or the court got into this with appellant's counsel, this issue initially, and I think it's because it's the most intriguing issue. As Mr. Waller stated, it's absolutely an issue of first impression. There's nobody that's ruled on this. But I want to go back to the circuit court's decision, because primarily we're here to determine whether the circuit court should be reversed. The plaintiffs brought this action to assert their alleged right to military leave under USERRA. USERRA, no question, under normal circumstances, and requires intent to discriminate based on military service or membership, and two, actual discrimination. So, as the plaintiff's counsel stated at the court trial, it wasn't Mr. Waller, it was his colleague, we're talking about someone not getting the same benefits as other similarly situated National Guard technicians. I think that is the proper definition of what they'd have to show for discrimination. And then it was discussed, hey, do you have to show this military animus? The reason the circuit court ruled the way it did was that USERRA, he determined that USERRA means what it says and says what it means. There are two tests. The threshold question, referred to by most cases in this area, requiring intent to discriminate, and the actual discrimination showing. And in term, it's been discussed about the circuit court raising this sua sponte, but I've never thought that was the case here, and primarily because of one thing. And if you look at the plaintiff's complaint in this case, two in the record, the trial record starts at page 2. They include the following allegations, which I'll quote. USERRA prohibits discrimination against persons because of their service in the uniformed services. USERRA protects persons from acts, I'm omitting irrelevant parts of the complaint paragraph, from acts of discrimination on the basis of that membership and performance of service or obligation.
So in order for the plaintiffs to have a cognizable claim here, they have to show that a two-star general himself, a serving military officer, has an anti-military animus?
Yep.
That seems pretty tough.
Well, the plaintiffs pled it, so I think when Judge Hoffman read this, it's a logical assumption that the plaintiff pled what they felt they had to prove. You're right. If you don't, you're doing exactly what you're criticizing us for in our argument on the application of 709 and 1.
Criticizing anyway. I'm just making some observations.
Yeah, that was a bad choice of words. I'm sorry. But It's the same process. The Third Circuit is where all these cases seem to have sprung from. The Third Circuit, true, has jurisdiction and hears most of the or all of the Merit System Protection Board appeals. But the Merit System Protection Board can't hear any case like this, not substantially similar, because they don't have jurisdiction to hear cases involving state employees. That does make a difference here. And going back to the allegations made by the plaintiffs in the complaint, I think Judge Hoffman had every right to think, didn't come up with it as a surprise, that, hey, they pled it, we got to prove it. And they can't prove it. And well, why should you not require
it? Regardless of whether it was a surprise or not, the issue is, I mean, the statute seems pretty clear. You get 15 days a year if you're serving in these dual role statuses, and then we've got the exception we have to figure out. But what's the basis for arguing that anti-military animus has to apply to that statute? Because I don't see anything in those statutes that say you have to also prove to get the 15 days, you have to prove that they did it because you were they were opposed to your military service.
That's a good question. What it does, what the answer that the point that the appellants would give would assume that USERRA is not as limited a remedy as it is. USERRA is a limited, specific remedy with criteria that have to be proven according to statute. It's not a broad-based, general, theoretical remedy. And what's to say that that USERRA should apply to every pay and benefit dispute? If you can't satisfy the anti-military animus, then it becomes an internal matter.
How would a person ever establish that a military branch or military officials have an anti-military bias?
Well,
and he also points out that there's no case in America that has reached such a holding.
No, there's no case that I could find. I agree with that. That's why this is a case of first impression, which needs to be resolved by someone. And I don't know that, and I don't agree that the Third Circuit has resolved it the way it should be resolved, because you're writing out a significant requirement of the statute. It's a statutory remedy that's very specific. So if you can't meet the remedy according to those specifics.
What specifics? You mean the purposes of USERRA?
Yeah, right.
Well, there's a number of cases that say that these aspirational purpose-based statutes really aren't themselves substantive statutes. I mean, the substantive provisions govern what's covered, what's discriminatory, what's prohibited, what's not. These aspirational statements of purpose, and there's a number of cases and other commentators who have said, hey, look, that's just what they want. That's just their purpose. Let's say this, though. Let's say for purposes of our discussion, if we determine that the anti-military animus holding of the circuit court is not a basis to affirm, can we press on with the legal issue?
Sure.
And resolve that? That's fair enough before us. There's nothing that we need to
remand
on that.
No, I assume we talk about both issues. Yep.
So in your brief, you made the comment that there are no separate Title X orders for these service members. And that may be true, at least in the record, because I couldn't find them. But are you sure that's true accurately, or that's actually true? Because it seems like there would be orders, because orders always are accompanying where a service member goes, what they do. So I was curious about that comment. There are no separate Title X orders. And it was made in the context of this overarching subsuming argument that you make.
I'm not aware of them. I don't believe they're in the record in Exhibit 1 if they exist.
Yeah, I don't think they are either.
Pardon me?
Yeah, no, I agree. I couldn't find them either.
And I know what you mean. I mean, you get on an airplane or you go to hear a report here, you got to have pull out of your pocket an order, right?
Something.
this is pure speculation. I assume and partly speculation because it fits with our theory of the case, they pulled out their AGR orders.
Well, they don't send, they don't tell them exactly where to go and what mission to support.
Yeah,
that
no,
seems to come from another source, I'm guessing. So.
So if they would have received just standalone Title X orders, would they be entitled to accrue and use benefits?
Well, that was discussed at trial, and the answer is because there is no, well, I'll start at the beginning. The testimony is yes. If you're a civilian dual status technician, you get a Title X order moving you to the status of Title X. So you leave your civilian employment. You are entitled to accrue under the theory of the law that the South Dakota National Guard has applied. You are entitled to accrue and utilize military leave. Reason being is there's no flat-out prohibition, and there's no overarching or applicable AGR order.
So let's say in Mr. Christensen's case, his first period of active guard and reserve duty began on the 4th of January 2017. So presumably at the beginning of the fiscal year, which is the calendar year, he would have immediately accrued 15 days of military leave.
That year?
Is your art for that fiscal?
About the following year you're on?
17.
Yep.
So can he, is, and I know this isn't really in front of us, and maybe you just say, I don't have an answer because it's not in front of you, but so could he use the 15 days while he's on AGR duty?
Our position, he can't accrue it or utilize it.
So 5 USC 6323A1 talks about accrual. It doesn't talk about using it.
Yeah, I understand.
Okay, so do you have some authority that says he can't use it?
The AGR prohibition, 709.
Okay. And 709G2 just says that 6323A1 doesn't apply for these dual service, these dual status technicians that serve in that duty under 101 T6. But if we look also at, I mean, there are clearly periods of time when I think by everyone's estimation, 709G2 would have effect, right? So, for instance, Mr. Christensen, staying with his example, serves, by my count, 423 days in that initial period of AGR duty. So for the 423, that would seem to satisfy the definition in 10 USC 101 D6, 180 days consecutive plus, okay. So would be maybe no accrual for that period of time. There are other periods of Title 32 service that are less than that, and then there's a large period of time from 11/18/2018 all the way to June 10th of 2021, totaling, again, by my count, 935 days of AGR duty, which looks consecutive and continuous. So no accrual there. Probably everyone would agree to that.
Yeah, we have things we agree on and things we don't, right? I think that's true.
Okay.
Well, my time is up. Thank you for your attention. It's it hurts your head to think about this.
Thank you. Mr. Lawler, you can proceed with the rebuttal. And as you do that, I have a question. You know, the discussion about the lack of Title X orders, does that matter?
First of all, it's incorrect.
Okay.
I don't know what, Justice Salter, you're looking at. I think you said Mr.
Christensen. I wasn't able to find him in the record.
Well, so I think the example that Your Honor is looking at is Mr. Christensen's. I happen to have Mr. Mays in front
okay.
of me as an example, both of whom, by the way, are with us today, both Mr.
So those Title X orders for those gentlemen are there? In the record?
I can't speak to Mr. They are. Yes, they are.
Got it.
So paragraph 6, so my friend's comment that, you know, there aren't any is incorrect. And maybe I'm fortunate or not fortunate in 28 years in the Marine Corps. I've read a couple of orders to myself. I know, Justice Salter, you have as well. Paragraph 6 reads modified to include, okay? An order's modification is an order. As Mr. Anderson pointed out, you get on an airplane, you've got to pull out an order. Well, you pull out these AGR orders. Again, that's why we're not talking about the four square pieces of paper. We're talking about the duty they performed, which triggers the analysis. But to my friend's point, yes, you would pull out this order that's now been modified twice. And it's dated December 14th, 2018. And for the court's reference, it's at page 150 in the record. And it's Mr. May's orders, and they're modified to include, to convert to Title X, Section 12302, which, by the way, is an involuntary activation. So 12302 is interesting because it's an involuntary activation of an individual or a unit for up to 24 months, at which point they're sent to Afghanistan. I mean, that's not HER duty.
So your view, or I guess I want to clarify, in the record, we will find those conversion orders from AGR to Title 10 and for every single one of these service
members. You will, and to be clear, it will be a paragraph, and on page 150, as I'm looking at here for Mr. May, it's paragraph 6. Paragraph 5 is also a modification. It just changed the dates, but they both...
And then let me... So then the next step is, your view is, once those orders are entered and that conversion is made, you're out of that exception. Because they're now performing different services, and they're entitled to the benefit under as Title 10 servicemen at that point in time as dual service individuals, and they have to serve at least 30 days, as I understand it, and they get their 15 out of that 30.
That's right.
That's your view as to all of the plaintiffs.
That's correct, Your Honor. And your analysis is spot on.
So with May, we have 291 days of 32, then 120 days of Title 10, then 851 days of 32. So your view is that the 120 days of Title 10 constitutes the time for which the accrual should occur?
Yes, ma'am.
And then do you get the full 15 regardless, or is there a prorate, or how does that work?
As Mr. Chief Justice pointed out, once you're on Title 10, that triggers the whole 15. So if you want to take the whole 15, as I mentioned to Justice Salter earlier, and September was a bad month example, but if that was the date, and Your Honor asked Mr. Anderson the same question, yeah, you can take it that day.
And so then it may change based on the fiscal year. When the fiscal year ends,
you get another
15 if you're still serving those 15 days and on Title 10.
Let's say we
duty.
Do six. I'm so but, sorry.
But,
to interrupt.
But what we're doing here is all you're asking us to say is, what does the statute provide? And then we'll go back to the trial court and figure out whether there's any additional leave that should have accrued and what that amounts to.
That's right, Your Honor. And just to clarify that point, if you went on Title 10 or active duty orders the last month of the fiscal year and it was for 60 days and you went through the first month of the next fiscal year, you could take all 30 in that 60-day period. I want to address something that, Justice Salter, you asked pretty specifically of Mr. Anderson. Can you serve on Title 10 and
That's
Title
30? That's my last question.
I'm right there with you,
okay.
Judge. Justice Salter, excuse me. You can't. And here's the clearest...
Like legally, you can't.
Legally cannot. And here's the clearest example I can give. Posse comitatus. So after Civil War, posse comitatus, federal forces cannot perform police functions. You don't want the Army or the Marine Corps stomping through cities and doing riot control. They can't do that. It's a great example, riot control. National Guardsmen and women can do those functions only under Title 32. You cannot do both. So if a guardsman or woman were on the streets in Los Angeles right now performing riot control, they are on either state active duty or Title 32. They cannot do that. It's illegal to do that on Title 10. Did that answer Your Honor's question?
Yeah, yes, thank you.
You left about 3 minutes on the clock on your initial argument, so I'm going to ask you one more question on the anti-military animus spot. My view of the statute is there are specific benefits, one of those being you get 15 days if you're dual status. That's a specific benefit the statute provide under the congressional statutes. Then there's this prohibition. You can't take adverse employment action. Now, arguably, taking away the 15 days is adverse employment action. But it's very general in terms of, you know, if you get terminated, if you're demoted, if something happens and it's adverse, you're going to have to prove anti-military animus in that situation because you don't have a specific statute that gives you the benefit. They could have, in theory, said you can never terminate anybody and all those sorts of things. But instead, they're going to require them to show anti-military animus or some form of discrimination because of that. That's why you were fired, or that's why the adverse employment action was taken. This is completely different. That's out of that. We're just talking about Congress gave them 15 days benefit. And they get that by statute, and it's done. Give me your response to that.
I don't know that I have a response, Mr. Chief Justice. That was exactly the analysis.
Okay.
I'm not trying to be flippant. That's exactly the analysis. And I think it's worth pointing out, and it's in our brief, but just to draw the court's attention, a benefit of employment is defined very broadly, and in fact, courts have said that military leave itself is a benefit of employment, the accrual and use thereof. I want to address one other thing, Justice Salter. You said earlier, my friend Mr. Anderson said that USERRA is very limited and specific. I respectfully disagree. In fact, it's exactly the opposite. When Congress enacted the STSA that we discussed in my opening, Congress said in enacting that and also in USERRA, it is our intention that this statute be liberally and broadly interpreted in favor of the service member. If there's a coin flip, the service member wins. Candidly, we don't think this is a coin flip question at all, but if it were, and the Supreme Court has held that since 1943 with the STSA, and as recently as 2 years ago, the Supreme Court, and it does every year, and another circuit says liberal, broad interpretation in favor of the service member, and the broad definition of benefit of employment, to Mr. Chief Justice's point a moment ago, there are lots of things here. So it's not limited. It's not specific. It's very broad. And then one more distinction to what Mr. Anderson said. The Federal Circuit does, in fact, hear cases like this all the time. In fact, it's the only place that hears these cases. We're here on a very novel issue today because of the dual nature of our clients being both state and federal employees. But these benefits, differential pay is a perfect example. I have dozens of them. And if we were to not prevail at the Merit Systems Protection Board, our sole venue is the Federal Circuit. So I respectfully disagree with Mr. Anderson, but the Federal Circuit hears a lot of these benefits cases that are solely available to members of the military, and they've held twice in Butterbaugh and in Adams that you don't need to show the anti-military animus. Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments this morning. The case is submitted. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.